Morning, everybody. Nice to see you all on the screen. I guess it seems like Tim can't hear the talk, right? It appears. Tim, can you hear me? Sounds like you can't. Anyway, the rest of you can, right? Yes. Yeah, I was looking forward to coming to Calgary in March, and this little virus made that impossible. So it's nice that we can meet anyway this way. Now I can go all over the place, zooming anywhere easily. No airplanes, no suitcases to pack, remembering my passport and everything. I don't have to worry about that on Zoom. Well, so I'm talking to you. It's becoming almost normal now, this craziness that we can't be in each other's presence, this virus that's causing so many deaths. I don't know what it's like in Canada, but there's a lot of deaths in America, United States. And the United States is very, doesn't like to look at unpleasant things, difficult things. So you don't really hear much about the deaths. And it's very sad because a lot of people are dying alone, you know, when they would have died with family around them. Now they're dying alone. I have one friend who's doesn't have the virus, but he's in really bad shape, and we would visit him a lot. Now you can't visit him because he's in a place where, you know, they don't allow anybody in because everybody, all the patients in the rehab facility are so vulnerable, so you can't go in. So our poor friend, who's in a terrible fix, has to be all alone, and this is repeated with literally 100,000 people, and more, far more than that in the United States. So it's kind of sad. And in the meantime, while that's going on, people are crowding in the streets. I'm sure you know about it in Canada, crowding in the streets in dismay, really, over another racist event. So it's a pretty rough and sad world that we're living in. But it's always been pretty rough and sad, and not too easy to be human. You seem to have the choice of either being overwhelmed with taking it all in, or denying it, thinking about something else to avoid being overwhelmed. And so that's a difficult thing. But the Dharma, I think, proposes another way. The Dharma proposes another way. It proposes a way of really taking it in, and having the taking of it in be a source of beauty and inspiration and strength rather than something that does us in. And I believe it. I think that really that is really possible, but it requires that we practice and that we continue our practice and that we support one another in our practice, because Zen practice is always together practice. We always support one another and practice side by side, even if we're side by side on the screen. So that's the subject of my talk today. I want to bring up a story from the from the Book of Serenity. It's the 63rd story in the Book of Serenity. Zhaozhou's great death. David, can you hear me? Put on your video, will you, so I can see you? I just see a sign that says David. There's David. Hi, David. And there's Lorena. Lorena, I haven't seen you forever. It's really nice to see you. And others of you, I'm not sure that I know you as well, but I know Lorena and David well. And the others of you, I've seen you, I'm sure. We've practiced together, I'm sure. Pardon me for not remembering as well. Anyway, this is the 63rd story in the Book of Serenity. Zsa Zsa once asked Tozi, "When someone who has undergone the great death returns to life, how is that?" And Tozi says, "She cannot go by night. She should arrive in the daylight." So I often reflect that, you know, Zen teachings are so great. They're unique, really, in world religious literature, because they're so odd. You know, and so you read a story like that and you think, what? What? You know, most religious literature, you read it and you may or may not agree with it or resonate with it, but you sort of think you know what it means. You know, here you really makes you wonder. It's very mysterious. Very hard to grasp what our Zen ancestors are telling us. And I don't think this is because somehow our Zen ancestors are trying to, be perverse or somehow, tweak our sense of logic and sense to keep us on our toes. I think that's not it. I think that they are really trying to express to us what reality is actually like. Because really and truly, you know, reality, whatever that is not something you pin down. It's not something you can define and feel that you have understood it. And it's not something that you can ever, ever, ever use up. And as soon as you think you have it pinned down, as soon as you think you know what's going on, you understand the world around you, or you even understand yourself, as soon as you think so, you know that suffering will soon follow, because you are swimming upstream. You're going against the truth, and it takes energy to do that, and it won't go well. Because life is always more than our conceptions of it. And if you let it, life will always surprise you. And you will always surprise you if you let yourself surprise you. And I hope that you do surprise you. And when you sit in Zazen, if you really pay attention, you know, you cannot say what exactly is going on. And you also cannot say who exactly are you. If you really look at what's happening when you're sitting in Zazen, you can't really pin it down and you can't use it up. People talk these days a lot about meditation, and maybe we think of Zazen as meditation, you know, calming the mind, maybe finding some insight, finding some liberation. But as we understand Zazen in the tradition, as Dogen speaks of it to us, we know that there's something else here. Meditation is included, but it's more than that. Or we could say less than that. Dogen says Zazen is going beyond Buddha, going beyond our understanding of Zazen. And to me, it's such a great relief, especially in the world as we see it now, to be able to sit down in the middle of emptiness, in the middle of an open sky. When students of religion or philosophy talk about Zen, they say, well, Zen is a non-dual teaching. I hardly ever use that term because I don't really know what it means, non-dual teaching. Some years ago, I was invited to make a presentation at a conference on non-dualism. And I was quite surprised to find that to almost all the speakers at the conference, non-dual meant oneness. Okay, that sort of makes sense. Either it's dual, which means, you know, two or more, or it's oneness. But to me, the concept of oneness is already dualism. Because you have oneness on the one hand, and dualism on the other hand, and that's already dualistic, right? And oneness and dualism seem like different things. I agree with oneness. I'm against dualism, you know, or vice versa. So it seems like oneness already is dualism, right? So I think what our tradition is saying is that holding on to any view as a true or ultimate view for all time is painful. It always leads to strife and fighting and confusion. When I am right and you are wrong, and when I know I'm right or I know I'm wrong, I'm already caught. Our Zen ancestors, like I was saying in the beginning, you know, I'm either overwhelmed or I'm in denial. I'm caught either way. Our Zen ancestors are telling us there is another way. We don't have to let ourselves fall into that trap. Sometimes reality arrives as one, sometimes reality arrives as more than one. In other words, non-dualism, whatever that is, must include dualism. If non-dualism doesn't include dualism, then it's dualistic itself. This is seems like an odd, you know, tricky thing to say. But the thing is that when you're actually living it, it's really the truth. And it's this truth that our Zen ancestors are always pointing to, and that's why their sayings and doings seem so odd to us. Because this is not the way we think about things. We have a very deeply embedded other way of thinking about things. And that way that we think about things is making us really suffer a lot. So oneness might be something like this. Okay, this happened. This is my life. This is what it is. Maybe I like it. Maybe I don't like it. Maybe I think it should be better. Maybe I'm working hard to improve it. Or maybe I just gave up and I'm settling for it. But anyway, this is what it is. It's like this. It really is like this. It's not some other way. And because it's this, it is. There's something awesome about it. Because that something is an awesome fact. Whether I like it or not, it's awesome. Or maybe oneness would be more like, so this is the world we live in. These are the terrible things that have happened for a long, long, long time. All the human mistakes and tragedies that ought to have been prevented, but they were not prevented. They do exist. They are real. They are true. And it's just like this. It's not some other way. And I must stand back, staggering with the awesomeness of it. And the beauty of it in its tragedy. So that would be a kind of oneness, kind of deep merging with things as they are. And dualism would be wrong is wrong, and I'm committed to doing what is right and good. Not what is evil and wrong. Dualism would be, I'm committed to making improvements in my own life and in the world around me. I'm committed to making the world a better place and making my life a better life. So, as we actually live, there's no way to do anything other than embrace both of these points of view at the same time. How else could we sustain a reasonable and good human life if we didn't both accept the beauty of what is, including ourselves and all of our flaws? We are all incredibly beautiful in what we've suffered, in what we are. And at the same time, I want to be a better person. I'm working on that. Both at the same time, not one or the other. Both at the same time. So Zhaozhou once asked Tozi, when someone who has undergone the great death returns to life, how is it? And Tozi says, she can't go by night, she should arrive in the daylight. So in Zen language, the great death means this oneness, letting go of all distinctions, all complaining, all manynesses, and seeing the profound oneness of everything, the empty nature of all dharmas, the same in their emptiness. And darkness and nighttime are metaphors, this, because in the dark, you know, there's no distinctions, right? Everything looks the same in total darkness. And in total darkness, there isn't anything. And there's nothing to grasp and nothing to hold on to. We can rest assured that all our descriptions and ideas about our lives are wrong. There is nothing. All things good and bad, desirable and undesirable, express that oneness. To experience the great death is to see personally for oneself in a way that no one else has seen. That everything is absolutely real and everything is absolutely unreal. That everything is absolutely true and nothing is true, because everything is just as it is. The Book of Serenity commentary to this story cites another story about this same monk Tozi. In this story, Tozi asks his teacher Kuewei, says, explain to me, please, the deepest truth of the Chan teachings. And Kuewei turns and looks at him. And Tozi says, please direct me. And Kuewei says, do you want a second ladle full of foul water? The great death is a necessary step in our practice or any other profound spiritual practice, but it's just a step. And it's called the great death for a good reason, because it really is a kind of death. Because you really do profoundly let go, give up. You really do throw away your life. And that sounds scary when you say it. You know, Dogen says, drop body and mind. Sounds scary when you say it. And it looks scary from the outside. But it's only scary if you think there's something to let go of, something to drop. If you think you have something, and now you're going to give it up, that's scary. But when you know there's nothing that you ever had, nothing to let go of, then letting go is quite easy. It's almost a kind of joke. And that's why I think there's so much humor in the Zen stories. Because in a way, our human predicament is a kind of joke, you know. It is so full of irony that we that we're making ourselves crazy by clinging to something that isn't even there. There's something absurd about this. To really be alive, you know, you have to die. It's the only way we live. And we do this. But until our actual time of death comes, you can't stay dead. You can never remain in the purity and peacefulness of oneness. You have to arrive in the daylight of this physical world of distinctions and messy problems and moral choices. Having died the great death, you know what a miracle it is, being alive. How strange it is. It's very strange, being alive. Very marvelous. Deeply tragic. And then you just have to go forth and see what happens. Because you have your part to play in this tragedy. In a way, you know, we could say all Zen stories are inherently dualistic because they're all about encounters between individuals. So when Kuewei faces Tozi in the story I just told you, he's saying to him, just as he turns around and looks at him, he's saying, look, look at me. I'm me, and you're you. We may be one, empty of any real difference or any real separation, but as long as we are alive, we are going to appear as two different people. This essential difference, even though it is provisional and unreal, constitutes our life. And when Kuewei turns and looks at Tozi, he is saying to him, just take a look here. Open your eyes and look at me. The teaching is right here in that act of looking. We are separate. We are one. That's what you see when you open your eyes. The whole world is actually quite clear. But Tozi doesn't see it, so he asks for an explanation. Can you explain, please? And then that's when Kuewei says, do you want another ladle full of foul water poured on you? To be alive in this world of human beings, plants, animals, flesh and blood, earth, sky, fire, water, is to be immersed in trouble. Because none of this would exist if it weren't for the grain of imperfection that is at the heart of all of it. All conditioned existence is suffering. That's what the Buddha taught at the very beginning. He saw this. The other day, for studying something else, I was reading in the Sutta Nipata, a short sutta, that, you know, somebody asks the Buddha, you know, how come there's so much trouble in the world? And then he gives explanations, and they say, how come that? How come that? How come that? And Buddha brings it all the way down. He says, well, okay, you want to know the basic problem? Consciousness. That there's consciousness at all. Because consciousness is dualism. I'm over here, conscious of you on the screen. Dualism. It's built into our consciousness. We would like to think we could escape into some ultimate goodness, some ultimate certainty, some ultimate peace, some ultimate oneness. And we hope, just as Tozi hopes when he goes to Kuewei for, you know, counsel, that our great religions will give us the answer. But all our religions and all our explanations are mixed and impure. Everything that we can be conscious of will be mixed and impure. And to really accept and fully embrace this is not to resign ourselves to a harsh world. It is to be liberated from the suffering that comes when we don't really understand and accept it. The story continues. Kuewei says this, and Tozi immediately gets it, as the Zen stories often end. He's awakened on the spot. He bows and gets ready to leave, and he turns to go, and as he's about to go, Kuei Wei says to him, "Don't fall down." Meaning, in this sad world of birth and death, do your best to remain on your feet and do the right thing. And it also means, I think, of course you won't be able to do that. You won't be able to stay on your feet. You won't be able to do the right thing all the time. You're going to make mistakes. So when you fall down, try to get up as gracefully as possible. To die the great death is to see and feel life as it is in all its sadness and beauty. Death is a beautiful culmination of a life. Death is a kind of end to dualism, right? It's perfect. But it's completely useless. Death doesn't accomplish anything. And we, who are alive, must do something. That's what being alive is. You do something. Sometimes people say, "Oh, I didn't do anything today." Well, of course you did. You laid in bed. You went to the bathroom. Doing something is being alive. You can't be alive without doing something. And we understand this in Zen practice, and we recognize that everything we do in this life is our expression of Dharma. We must express ourselves. That's what Tozi says to Zhaozhou in our original story. You can't do it at night, right? You must come forth in daylight. As I said in the beginning, in the United States, in the press, they talk about nothing but the pandemic almost every day. It's a little bit changing now that people are on the streets talking about racism. But before that, everything you read in the paper, every possible angle on the pandemic is discussed in the paper. And the numbers are given of how many have died. But nobody really pays attention to the reality of these deaths. In New York City, I have 2 children and 3 grandchildren who live in New York City, where 20,000 people have died in less than 2 months. Do you know what that means? What do they do with 20,000 bodies in 2 months? They do not have the facilities. There's a certain kind of number. A lot of people in New York, a lot of people die every day anyway, but not that many, so they don't have the capacity to deal with 20,000 corpses. It's a huge problem of organizing, finding the families, disposing of the corpses. What do you do? How do you take care of them? Where do you keep them? And it's an immensity of grief and sorrow. And you know, we haven't even begun to think about how do we grieve. This is like a national moment of grieving. And so far, not a peep about this in our coming from our press, coming from our government, not a peep about grieving. Grief is too real. People can't face it. And yet, these people were going to die anyway. Just like us. And they were dying. A little bit. Every day. Just like us. With each exhale, losing our life by the measure of that one exhale. our having my life. That's mine. Has always been a literally painful illusion. And the change of state from life to death is very slight. The curtain between life and death is far thinner than any of us believe. From within the great death, everything is acceptable, everything is all right, all of the time. Things are as they are, not some other way. But we are alive in this world of difference and strife. In this world of wars and political divisions and pandemics and prejudices of every stripe, this is where we live. And this is also oneness. Because form is emptiness. Emptiness is form, right? As we chanted. There's no difference between oneness and manyness. Oneness and manyness are ways of speaking. In the light of this, there's only me and you doing what we can do to bring some goodness to our world. We follow precepts. I know some of you have taken precepts formally, but even if you haven't taken precepts formally, as a human being, you have a sense of decency and goodness. There's really no two ways about it. Don't kill. Never kill. Don't support killing. Try to prevent killing when and however you can. Support and promote life and do whatever you can do to nurture it. And when the killing happens anyway, as it certainly will, grieve with bitter tears the innocent death, because you are a human being. And that's what human beings do in this sad and terrible world. And as long as we are alive, that's how it is. And that's how it's going to be. Of course, it can be more or less drastically that way, and we need to work every day tirelessly to make it better. But it will never be a time when we'll stop this work of making things better. Because it's also human to make things worse. Sometimes people debate, you know, are human beings good or are they evil, you know, basically. What a ridiculous debate. Human beings are Buddha, our tradition holds, because life is Buddha. When you understand this, you know, you must always, always, always forgive. Maybe you don't forget, but you forgive. And you know that it's impossible to go forth with bitterness and vengeance or hatred. It's impossible to go forth with a sense of moral superiority, because you are you and not someone else. You know there's going to be some kind of trouble. And that when there's evil in the world, you are also responsible for it, because the evil of the world is our evil collectively, and no one escapes implication. So you protect as you can, you defend as you can, but you never condemn. There's a line, the same story, which is 63 in Book of Serenity, also is in the book Blue Cliff Record, and it appears there as the 41st case. And in the commentary on that version of the story, it says, where right and wrong are mixed, even the sages don't know. They walk on thin ice. They run on a sword's edge. It is hard to know what to do. It's hard to know how to live. The more you know, and the more you understand something about a particular situation, the more confusing it is. And I think this is one of the great facts of our time. Maybe more than ever before, we know so much more And the more we know, the less we can be sure about what's right and wrong action. This pandemic time has been an example of this, where every day you get a different idea about what's going on. The more we know, the less we know, right? The less certain we are. The more doubt there is, the more we know. So you can't be self-righteous. You can't claim moral superiority. You can't claim to really know what's going on and really know what to do. Not even a sage knows. We're all walking on thin ice. And yet, we have to walk and do our best. We make the best choices we can. When we make a mistake, we realize it, we change course. What doesn't change course is our commitment to the precepts and to the human goodness that they represent. The Blue Cliff Record poem about this story says, "Even the ancient Buddhas have never arrived. I don't know who can scatter dust and sand." Scattering dust and sand is a kind of means teaching Zen. Scattering dust and sand, that's what it's called. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm scattering dust and sand. A very dubious proposition. Because no one really understands these teachings, right? And when we try to talk about them, we can rest assured that we'll be misleading people. But we're human. We talk. That's what we do. Not even a Buddha has this figured out. And none of us really know what to do. I think we all know the three pure precepts of Zen. They're very, very early in Buddhism. Avoid evil, do good, benefit all beings. A lot of the time, you know, we really don't know what that means. A lot of the time, we're not sure about how to do it. But it's our clear commitment. It's the effort that we make over a lifetime. And we carry it on with energy, with appreciation, with forgiveness, with understanding, and with grief. So that's what I wanted to tell you this morning. Thank you very much for listening. It's very sweet. There's 20 of us here this morning, so that means I can see everybody at the same time, except for Phoebe, whose camera is off, but everybody else I can see. So it's very sweet. In a way, you know, like somebody said to me, when I gave a talk and there were a lot of people in the room, the people in the back rows, I couldn't really see them. But on Zoom, I could see them all. So I could see all of you close. Oh, Phoebe just put on her camera, right? Is that you, Phoebe? Hi. Anyway, thank you very much for listening. And we have a few minutes now. I don't know how long, but I'm happy to talk with you if you have something to bring up. I think that maybe to make it organized, if you raise your hand, you know how to raise your hand? If you go click on the participant button, if you raise your hand, I can see that on my screen, and I can call on you. And then that way we won't have the problem of talking at the same time when two people, with 20 people, we might have a problem talking at the same time. So if anybody wants to bring something up, and this doesn't have to be some like great question or something like that, it can just be something you want to say. So if you want to say something, please raise your hand. Tim is raising his actual hand. Okay. So now it looks like you can hear me now, Tim, right?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
It was on a little long. It's just very quiet. So
I see.
I have to hold it right up to my ear.
I see.
Lawn's being mowed just outside. So.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, yeah, what would you like to say, Tim?
Well, of course, to thank you and to say how glad I am that your health continues, and my wish that your family and your sons and grandchildren are safe and healthy in New York, and your Sangha, I see what great things they're doing. So I want to start by just being grateful for you.
Thank you.
And for what you're doing. I would also like to say that if you're, even though you're, you might be casting dust and sand, I always appreciate how when you say things like that, you do it with a smile on your face. And that, you know, you could say that just as easily with a different tone and a different expression, and it would mean something completely different. But to say tossing sand and dust and smile while you say it, it's a great sort of relief and takes me in a direction that I'm happy to go down. So thank you also for that. And I just wanted to also mention that years ago, I read about something called E-prime, which is a version of the English language that somebody had come up with that is exactly like the usual form of English, except it has done away with all the words that are is or related to is. Hmm. And they had a whole list of reasons why they thought the English language was really handicapped by including those particular kinds of words in the language. And they were able to create a language, a version of English that is totally comprehensible, because the article I read was written in E-prime, and I only learned that at the end of the article when it said, this whole article is written in E-prime.
Hmm.
So the problem of this is or is not, and so on and so forth, since that and through practice, I'm just in the duality and the non-duality of duality and so on and so forth. It's just, and unfortunately, I lean into the overwhelmed side of your equation in the grand prospect of this. And I try on occasion to lean more into this center place. If you have a single turning word on trying to encourage somebody from the realm of the overwhelmed into that mysterious third way, I'd be very happy to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, before I say something about that, let me also apologize to you especially, but to everybody in the Sangha, because you introduced me in the beginning as your teacher and the guiding teacher of the Sangha. So I apologize to you and to everybody for doing such a bad job of that, because I don't do anything, right? I give you no guidance. I visited this Sangha like once in all of its years of being in existence. So I apologize for, I really am very bad. There are people who give guidance and help of all sorts and, you know, stay up late worrying about how is Tim doing and how's everybody in Calgary doing. So sorry that I'm such a slouch. But I do care, and I am here. I am here if you need me. But I suppose that not only am I selfishly like not paying attention to you, but I guess I also do feel like you know what to do, and you'll be okay. And it's better for you to find your own way. It's the worst case scenario is everybody listens to me, and every time they go to the bathroom, they call me up and ask me how that should be done. You know, so I don't. This is would be a very bad thing. So I don't want to do that. However, I think I may be a little bit way on the other side of that. So I do apologize. And as far as what you were saying, that is the question, isn't it? For all of us. And you know, I think it's not a mystery, and I don't think it's very hard. It's very complicated. I mean, the real thing about it is to know when we're being overbalanced. In other words, to know when we're really going off. Here's what it feels like for me when I'm going off the deep end. Here's what it feels like in me. Here's the kind of thoughts that I start having. Here's the way it feels in my body. Here's the way it starts to feel in my life. Here's the way my perception feels when I am overcome with my confusion. I feel it now. I know what's happening. So I'm going to stop right now, and I'm just going to return to my body, literally to my breathing in this present moment for one or two breaths. I'm going to return to myself for one or two breaths. And then I'm going to go on knowing that maybe I can't make my mind be different, because look at all the conditions in my life. You know, my whole life brought me to this moment of confusion and pain. So I'm not going to be able to make it go away, but at least I understand what it is, and I can step back into my breath for a few breaths, and that makes all the difference. And if I do that, if I have a habit and a practice of doing that over and over and over again, every time I find myself overwhelmed and acting out in a bad way, little by little by little, I will get some purchase on that, and I'll be able to have a sense of humor about it, and I'll be able to know that, well, this is not the moment for me to be, you know, talking to people or making big decisions or, you know, rushing around too much, because I know it's going to happen if I do that. So I'm not going to do that. And little by little by little, I can roll back that habit. And it's a lifetime's work. And we never feel like, oh, I've got that down now. I'm immune. No, nothing can ever happen now. No. I think we're all always working on this. That's why it says, you know, even the Buddha has not arrived yet. From a Zen point of view, you know, Zen's the only tradition that I'm aware of that says, that'll say stuff like that. The Buddha's not there yet, you know. Other traditions in Buddhism don't say that. Although I think if you study, as Dogen studies deeply, the sutras, I think the sutras do say that in a way, beyond Buddha, you know, Buddha goes beyond Buddha. Yeah. So anyway, thank you for the question. It is the question. It's the most important question, yeah.
Thank you very much. And just finally, I mean, for what it's worth, your apology is in some ways it's very sweet to hear. And the way I look at it is, I've told people that I often feel like I'm haunting my apartment, and I never knew you could haunt your own home during this pandemic. And I've often felt like that you very sweetly haunt our community, where your books and your teachings and things you've said to me, things you've said during retreats, things that are in your books, things that people have said about you, things I say about you, whether or not you're this heavy, you're obviously not a heavy-handed anything. So have faith that the way you haunt this community is the most beautiful way anybody could haunt anything.
That's so sweet. Thanks for saying that. Now, Andy has his or her hand up. Where's Andy at?
Right here.
Good. Yeah, there you are. Good.
Please. I was just going to second what Tim had to say. Though I think when you first came up 6 or so years ago was the first time I actually was able to sit with you. And it has stayed with me forever. And in fact, in the past week, as I was thinking about your coming again, I ended up with a rewrite of something we discussed in Dokusan about practice like your hair is on fire. And it occurred to me, if my hair is on fire, should I douse it with water or roast marshmallows? It seems like in this day and age, that seems to be a constant question. And I want to thank you for being there and presenting me with that. Uh-huh. So thank you, and I appreciate your presence today. Thank you.
Thank you, Andy. Yeah, it's I really had such a good time when I was there last time, because I love that place where we had the retreat. I have a soft spot in my heart for funky old Catholic places, you know, which were formerly nunneries or like Catholic schools. They have this. There's something really great about them. I really love them. And that place was nice. I had a nice room, and there was like a gym around the corner where I could go and in the break and run around and sweat. So I really do hope I'll be able to come back. Yeah. Anybody else have something you want to say? Yes, Lorena, take yourself off of mute and speak.
Yeah. Hey, Norman, it's so wonderful to see you again. Your Dharma talk was very meaningful for me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And I've been so happy since you entered to the group.